When we finally got around the trees to where we could see it, there was kind of a break, an opening there, and there this thing was, you know. There was no mistaking, this was a metallic object hovering in the sky there, less than 100 feet away. So I jumped out of the truck and started towards it, thinking it would be gone before I got close. At one point, you know, I got to where I was looking up at an angle, a pretty steep angle at it, and it suddenly started to move. It rose up a little, not real steady. It was kind of an unsteady motion, and the sound got louder. Like it was powering up. It was real, you could feel it as well as hear it. And it scared me, so I jumped down behind the end of a log that was sticking out of this pile of debris. And those guys were really frantic at screaming at me to get back in the truck. And I didn't need them to tell me that. I was thinking, how am I going to, you know, get out of here? So I was thinking I would raise up and take off, just make sprint back to the truck. But when I raised up, I just felt this shock go through my body. It's kind of like an electric shock. That's the way it felt, and I just blacked out. But the guys in the truck said that a bolt of energy came out of the bottom of this craft and hit me in the upper body, and it threw me back through the air.
The story of Travis Walton, it is living UFO history, and it happens tonight here on this program. Travis Walton, who inspired Fire in the Sky, and fellow logger, the crew boss, the man who hired Travis Walton. This story never would have been possible without Mike Heston Rogers, I think I can fairly say. They are here. They're here to set the record straight. There's no Hollywood spin. We're going to give you just the facts, and people are wondering, well, can they say anything more? I don't know, gentlemen. Can you say anything more? Welcome to the program.
Yeah, Jeremy, I can say a little bit more.
Hello, Travis. How are you tonight?
Hello. Yeah, there's plenty of stuff around the edges over the years, but Mike's right. There's lots of stuff that never gets out there in the main telling of what happened.
So, Mike, why did you hire Travis to join your crew back in 1975? Or was it before 1975?
He was already experienced in the woods. He'd worked loading pulp, cutting pulpwood for the mill. And, he was willing and eager. So,
And Travis, this work you wanted to do, or were you just trying to make a living?
Well, yeah, I guess I didn't view it as a career, but it was a job that I, like Mike said, I'm familiar with the machinery and the environment, and so I was also not friends with him and his brother, it was just an association that kind of led naturally to joining them in the woods.
I hired Travis's brother before that, Dwayne.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah,
that's worked
right.
For me for
yeah,
a while.
Right. Yeah, that
was Dwayne your older or younger brother, Travis?
He was my older brother.
Good workers, Mike?
Oh, yeah, both of them.
And hard work, right, Travis?
Yeah, mm-hmm. it was arduous and physically demanding, but... You know, nobody would take the job if they couldn't take the challenge. Not everybody got away unscathed, though. It's a dangerous kind of work, too.
So, Mike, how many hours had you worked the crew that day?
Oh, I think we worked past 8, probably close to 10 altogether.
It was a long day.
Yeah, and you remember about what time you started before the sun came up, was it?
Yeah, just
well,
a little
we
less
drive so thunder. Far to get there, you know. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, we had to drive almost an hour to get there, maybe a little more than an hour, depending on how fast you drive. Of course, I never drove fast, but
you did that night.
Well, yeah. After we saw that, and then I drove pretty fast, way too fast for that road.
Did you guys ever have a fascination with lights in the sky, with UFOs, with aliens, with anything paranormal or anything like that. Travis?
Well, I wouldn't call it a fascination, but I think it's a topic that just about everybody has discussed at some point, you know, even if they're people who are afraid of it, so they just say it can't possibly be because they don't want it to be, you know.
Yeah, well, Travis is forgetting an incident that happened about 5 years before that, back in 1970. It was just a sphere that came down out of the clouds and just kind of, I mean, it stayed there quite a while because we saw it from Snowflake. We were headed to the valley to go to the last day that they were having this Big Sur area, you know, where you could actually surf. And we were headed there, and so we saw this in Snowflake. I thought at first it was a street light, and then we got a little closer and a little closer. It took about 10 minutes or so to even get up close to it. When we did, of course, it had a light came out of the bottom of it and shone down the ground, and we weren't the only ones to see it. There was a busload of high school kids, football players, on the way home. And it was after dark, and that was quite something else. I don't want to get way into that because I know that's not something you want to discuss here. But you know, that happened to us 5 years prior to 1975.
Do you recall that, Travis, as well?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. There were some other people that lived in the community that we were passing through that also saw it, too. And some of them that actually came to work with us in the woods later. It was a pretty profound sighting, yeah. But it didn't make us, you know, like you use the term fascinated with the subject, but, you know, it was a thing of interest. But we had pretty wide-ranging discussions.
Yeah. So that night, we already have established that, you know, it's grueling work, it's hard work, you've worked a long day, you're probably just trying to get back and take a shower, which is something I don't think Travis got to do for about a week. But you were trying to get back home after a long day. And I guess, Travis, tell us what you guys saw, because you were all kind of crammed together in this truck, as Mike says, you know, going down this not so stable road in Snowflake, Arizona.
Oh, near Snowflake.
Yeah, well, it was just a glow through the trees. Pretty thick growth there, so we couldn't see the source of the light at first, so it's not anything alarming at first. It was just the more odd it seemed the closer we got.
Mike, what was your recollection of this?
Well, just exactly that. Of course, I remember all the details. I don't think you have a week or two here.
Oh,
but
Mike was well known for having extremely keen vision. It was actually kind of phenomenal, his ability to see things.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I don't know what kind of vision you call that, but sort of like a hawk, you might say, something like that.
might be a little bit of Jedi vision as well. I don't know.
Oh, Jedi, yeah.
Intuitive,
yeah, maybe. If I could rely on that, that'd be great. But you can't rely on intuition or, you know, apprehension. Apprehension is actually a form of a sense perception, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
But it's not always accurate. Of course, you can't believe in what you see either, can you? And that's the eyes are the number one, right?
Travis, I'll just ask you, do you felt like, whether at that time or now, you know, more than 45 years later, that this thing, like, you were drawn to it in some way?
Well, you know, I got out as it was kind of a show of bravado, actually, you know. And I assumed that it was going to, you know, take off before I got very close. But I slowed down when I saw that it wasn't zipping off like I assumed.
And I think from what I've read on your website and in your books and seen in your movies, that if you had to do it over again, you wouldn't have. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. It was the most terrifying times of my life. And I wish I'd never got out of that truck.
At the same time, you wouldn't have gone through what you have gone through, which is in many ways good.
Oh, well.
I mean, Travis,
you have to look for the good side in things, even when they're terrible.
I mean, Travis, you do say that, you know, in Travis, the true story of Travis Walton, one man's survival after a terrifying journey, that if you can turn this into something good and help it be your life's purpose, you'd be right there on the doorstep.
Yeah, I'm not just me, but all of the guys who experienced this, if they can, you know, try to unravel it and make some good come of it, you know, I think I would love to do that. I think Mike would love to make something good come of it.
Oh, you bet. I've been trying to.
Yeah, I've seen some of Mike's stuff, and I'm really looking forward to delving more into that. There's some questions that are coming in through the chat, and maybe not necessarily questions, but some comments, and so they're bringing up some points. And one of them is the fact that, I mean, we'll get more into the story here. We're not done, but we'll deal with these questions as they come in. What was it like, Mike, to be accused of lying and potentially murder? Not just you, but the crew you hired.
Well, of course I didn't like it, but I also found it funny because we obviously didn't kill him. And that's why I accepted, you know, well, I was kind of reluctant at first, but, you know, then I accepted the sheriff's demand, really, that we take lie detector tests because I knew that they would be all right. Of course, we got into the building there that morning. The first thing we met was this stern-faced guy that looked as though he wasn't there to find the truth. He looked as though he was there to do just the opposite.
Send us to jail.
Fact, yeah, Cy Gilson. Yeah, is his name. He died, here a year ago, something like that. In fact, So did Sheriff Gillespie. They're both gone. Both those guys are gone. And half my crew.
Yeah. Yeah. Who's left, Mike? Who's left?
Who's left? Steve Pierce, John Gillette, Travis and I.
Yeah, that's
awesome. I haven't got any actual proof that Ken Peterson is dead, but he's been missing for like 5 years now. Do you know anything about that, Travis?
Yeah. There have been sightings. He desires not to be in the public eye, but he's still alive.
It really deeply affected him.
Yeah, very deeply affected everybody.
Yeah, he showed it a lot more than some others.
Yeah, he did. Well, him and Steve. Now, Steve did it that night, but since then, he's really rebelled against the idea that he ever cried or was ever upset. He wanted to be a man, you know. And he's accosted both Travis and I about that several times. And
he was angry about that and claiming it wasn't true, but you know, the other crew members knew it was true, and it was no shame, because I think everybody, you know, on that crew eventually cried in some regard to what happened.
Oh, yeah. You know, John Gillette, right there in Travis's movie, you know, the Travis movie, said right there at the beginning that probably most upset there was Steve Pierce. and they're really close buddies right now. I think they always have been.
But there's no shame in that. I mean, who wouldn't be? You know, the idea that a grown man would cry is not a shameful thing at all.
It's not a measure at all.
Of how much of a man you are. It's a measure of the
measure of what's inside, isn't it, Travis?
Yeah,
I think so.
Well, probably been accused of worse things than any of the guys. I mean, I was not only accused of murder, but I was accused of running off and leaving Travis. A lot of people came down on me pretty hard about that. And, you know,
Mike did not deserve that, because he was the crew was screaming at him, according to their story, was get us out of here, you know.
Yep.
So, you know, in a confused situation where something terrible just happened and they think they're next, it was the only logical, responsible thing to do for Mike to get the rest of his crew to safety.
I went down the road a quarter of a mile, and I stopped the truck, and everybody there was saying, "What in the world are you doing?" They were yelling at me, you know. I was saying, "Well, I'm not going any further because we left him back there." And, you know, the rest is history, the rest of the story.
In the immediate aftermath, you're probably thinking, right, Mike, I have to get out of here, and I have to get my crew out of here, because if whatever and whoever in this craft may have just, you know, killed one of my workers with this beam of light that zapped down from this craft, I mean, what's to stop them from doing that to your entire vehicle? You were thinking, get my guys to safety.
Yeah, that was my thought, because they were all yelling at me about that, and it was kind of a plea, you know. So of course, and thing of it is, I had the truck was actually turned off, because Travis had jumped out of the truck and I couldn't see the thing from where I was sitting, you know. It was up above, you know. I had to lean over kind of in Ken's lap to see the thing. And before that time, I had turned the truck off. So once everybody's screaming, you know, get the hell out of here, it actually took me a couple of seconds or so to turn the truck back on. And then, of course, the engine had to rev up, and then I peeled out, you know. So it was a few seconds before I actually left the scene after Travis had been knocked back and presumed dead, because he hit the ground hard and dust kind of rolled up around him a little bit. And he definitely looked dead. So it took a few seconds. But, you know, once I did, and these guys are acting like, why aren't you going already? I mean, they had that sort of tone in their voice, you know. Oh, once I did get that truck to life, I took off quite fast.
So, Travis, your last recollection of this was what? I mean, when did you black out? Have you been able to establish that?
Well, I didn't really see the beam that hit me. I just felt this numbing shock. And what it was is, it was right at the instant I stood up, and I think that what happened there is it kind of decreased the distance between my head and the surface of this thing. The crew was pleading with Mike, according to what they tell me, not to go back, and I think his insistence was pretty heroic in light of the danger that they perceived at the time.
And so Mike, Travis was gone when you got back, right?
Yeah, he was gone. And the thing was gone. But of course, I and at least two of the other guys saw it, a light raise up and streak off from where I stood. It was actually towards the northeast, you know, kind of low, but going upwards. And we saw that. And so, and that's what told me, you know, that it was gone. And I actually expected to go back and find a charred body or a dead body, you know. And some of the other guys did too. I mean, I think they all did.
Did you guys sleep on this, or did you immediately report it?
We immediately reported it just as quick as we got into town. The first phone booth we came to, Ken Peterson got out and called the local authorities, you know, which was Chuck Ellison.
Did you want him to come to the scene and check it out themselves, or was that the idea?
Well, not to the scene, because we were in Heber. You know, the where it happened was back up the hill, like 12 miles. We were in Heber at the first phone booth, and Ken Peterson called the Deputy Ellison, and he came right over. I mean, like within 10 minutes or so. And then, of course, we told him the whole thing, and then he called Sheriff Gillespie in Holbrook, and Holbrook Gillespie was there in like 45 minutes from the time we was called. And I thought it was rather odd that Gillespie would come all the way down there just because somebody was missing at night, you know? Because, you know, Travis wasn't a kid, you know? He wasn't a child missing or anything. But it was, I think it was the UFO part of the story that we all eventually told the sheriff. I mean, we told that to Deputy Ellison, but we I'm pretty sure that had a lot to do with why Gillespie came down there in person.
Do you remember what that call went like, Mike? Was he hysterical as he was talking, you know, and reporting this?
Ken? No, he was very mild. In fact, he didn't even tell Allison on the phone he said nothing about a UFO. That came after Allison came down.
Very interesting. We're talking with Mike Heston Rogers and with Travis Walton. Travis's story inspired Fire in the Sky. It was made into a Hollywood movie. It was done the Hollywood way, not necessarily the factual way. We're talking with them tonight in a once in literally a lifetime interview. I'm Jeremy Scott from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest. On Into the Paranormal, I'm Jeremy Scott. Fire in the Sky.
Save your data and listen for free by calling 701-719-9703, courtesy of TalkStream Live.
This is Brad Bernards with Parabnormal News. After traveling several billion miles toward the sun, a wayward young comet-like object orbiting among the giant planets has found a temporary parking place along the way. According to NASA.com, the object has settled near a family of captured ancient asteroids called Trojans that are orbiting the sun alongside Jupiter. This is the first time a comet-like object has been spotted near the Trojan population. The unexpected visitor belongs to a class of icy bodies found in space between Jupiter and Neptune called Centaurs. They become active for the first time when heated as they approach the sun and dynamically transition into becoming more comet-like. Visible light snapshots by NASA's Hubble Space Telescope reveals that the vagabond object shows signs of comet activity, such as a tail, outgassing in the form of jets, and an enshrouding coma of dust and gas. A new comet is on its way in toward the sun, with prospects that it may become bright enough to see with the unaided eye by year's end, according to a report in space.com. The object in question is Comet Leonard and was discovered by astronomer Gregory J. Leonard on January 3rd at the Mount Lemmon Observatory, also known as the Mount Lemmon Infrared Observatory. The observatory is located on Mount Lemmon, about 17 miles northeast of Tucson, Arizona. Mr. Leonard is a senior research specialist for the observatory's Lunar and Planetary Laboratories Catalina Sky Survey. When Mr. Leonard found the comet's image, it was an exceedingly faint object of magnitude 19 that's nearly 160,000 times dimmer than the faintest stars visible to the unaided eye. There's more news at parabnormalradio.com. I'm Brad Bernards, Parabnormal News.
There was no mistaking this was a metallic object hovering in the sky.
Travis Walton of Snowflake leaped from the truck and ran up for a closer look.
And they're yelling at me, get out of there! And I stood up, bam!
His companions say he was struck by a bluish light emitting from the craft.
Threw me back through the air 20 feet. They took me for dead.
Walton claims he woke up inside of an alien craft, lying on a table surrounded by three aliens and other human-looking figures.
They were basically humanoid-looking, you know, small, 4 or 5 feet tall. Very large heads and enormous eyes.
Search parties comb the area. His buddies and brother-in-law tell the story of an alien abduction. Walton and the crews take lie detector tests and pass them.
I had a whole town disbelieving us. I had the police disbelieving us, and we were accused of murder, and I had to deal with all of that. Fortunately, they brought him back.
No boring politics, just tales of UFOs, aliens, Bigfoot, and earth-shattering science. You're traveling into the paranormal.
It's Fire in the Sky. My guests are Travis Walton and Mike Heston Rogers, and I'm Jeremy Scott from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest. Here's Travis with Mike's logging crew near Snowflake, Arizona. Rural area, rural logging area. 1975 in November. Probably pretty cold. Was it cold, Travis?
Yeah, that's what I recall that they were saying. It was getting to around 8 degrees at night. So the idea that a deranged person is just wandering through the woods would have froze to death. And that's just that theory just didn't pan out. And plus, the searchers were very thorough.
So it was pretty cold. And you were gone for quite some time when you came back and you, I guess, came to. What was your first conscious memory?
Well, pain. You know, I was, I felt a shortness of breath, like I was suffocating. But the pain was pretty intense. I didn't know where I was at first, and then I recalled approaching that craft and thinking that I must have got hurt in the process of escaping. But when I finally opened my eyes, I saw these creatures. There was a light above me, and it wasn't really extremely bright, but this pain in my head was intensified just by looking at it. So I tended to keep my eyes shut, but when I looked and saw these beings standing either side of me, I just freaked out. And not my, that's actually my least favorite part of telling this whole experience.
Is the beings that you encountered, Travis?
Yeah.
I can imagine.
It was, they were small, but the eyes were just so riveting. It was just something that was unbearable, you know, to look into these eyes. It's like they were looking not just at me, but into me, you know, like they had some sort of, or attempting some kind of telepathic contact. But it just gave me a real squirmy feeling in my head that was hard to deal with.
Did you feel as if they were putting thoughts into your head?
No. In retrospect, I think that what was happening there was that they weren't able to control me telepathically due to the leftover damage from that beam striking me. Interfered with their ability to get into one's head.
So they literally, because of the means that they used to knock you unconscious and in which to take you, they then weren't able to communicate with you fully, telepathically.
Yeah, coincidentally, or as a result of, but, you know, for many years, I took it as given that they had fired an energy at me, but in thinking on it later, I was thinking that perhaps it was just some sort of an accident, some sort of an energy that jumped to ground through me because I was the closest to the surface.
Mike, you care to weigh in on any of this? I mean, it's been a lot.
He tells it pretty good. I mean, I wasn't there. I mean, I was home or out in the woods somewhere or whatever, you know, during that time. He doesn't even know when that occurred, actually. He doesn't know when it was immediately or several days into the fact, you know, when he was gone.
What part, Mike? What part?
When he woke up aboard the craft.
Okay. So, yeah. Travis, so you were unsure how much time had gone by.
Right. It like Mike said, it could have been either right after I was hit or taken aboard, or towards the end. You know, that conscious period, I don't know when it occurred.
All right. Do you remember how many of these beings you were? There were.
Three.
All right. And from what I've heard, you say that they appeared humanoid.
Yeah, a lot of people don't understand the term humanoid. A humanoid just means two arms, two legs, a head on top. You know, it's just a general outline of morphology, I guess you would call it. Hollywood really prefers that for the monsters that they put in movies, because that way an actor can fit in a suit. and so the idea of humanoid is basically following the outline of a human, not necessarily looking like a human.
Gotcha. So did you feel intimidated by their presence?
No, I was totally terrified. They were between me and the door. I just wanted to escape, just get away any way I could.
And what I was wondering is, were you aware, like, of your position on this plane of existence, like whether you were airborne or you were on the ground, or whether it was even safe to exit the craft?
I couldn't see outside. At one point, I could see what looked like a star pattern, but I don't know whether that was a projection of a navigational map or where it actually was at the time. It wasn't like a window. It was more like the surface of the craft or something.
And so you fought. You tried to get out. How close did you get?
Well, in exploring and looking for a way out, eventually a real human-looking person came in, which I immediately, maybe erroneously, but I interpreted as being a rescue by some Earth agency. And this male person led me out of the craft.
And did you walk down a ramp of some sort?
Yeah. So, you know, at this point, it was inside of this larger craft or larger building, some sort of an enclosure. And I was mainly concerned with where he was taking me and, you know, was this a rescue? Because he wasn't answering my questions. And there were a lot of them.
So it's as if they just left you out in the middle of nowhere.
The alien-looking creatures, you know, the non-human-looking ones, no longer attempted to, you know, physically control me. That wasn't working. So if it was supposed to be telepathic control, that wasn't working. I think the reason I'm saying that is because of the medical tests that were done afterwards in terms of brain wave scans and such things. There was some indication that there was some residual injury that faded as time went on.
I can imagine. And so when you came to, were you dehydrated? Were you drained of energy? I know you had a five-day growth of beard.
Yeah, I was hungry and thirsty, and medically verified that I was, you know, dehydrated. There were a whole battery of medical tests, EKG, EEG, a thorough physical exam, and the important thing is that, you know, there were people who came up with wild claims about the condition of my body that were not verified by the medical examination that was performed. People eager to claim they knew something about this were making claims that just weren't true.
So you yourself at one point also made a phone call for help after you were returned, as Mike said. Returned.
Yeah.
Or brought back, yeah.
That's true. Yeah, I ran down into the town, which I immediately recognized. I'd been through there many times in my life. And found a telephone and called my family. And there's even interesting stories around that, people claiming that... first thing I did was phone them And that just didn't happen. There's a guy I knew, but there's no way in the condition I was in he would be the one that I would call, even though he lived in the town I was calling from. I wouldn't have known his number. And the real evidence is that because I had to make the call collect, I was talking to an operator who could, you know, hear the hysteria in my voice and listened in on the call and reported it to the sheriff. So the idea that there was any other call or that the call wasn't made, as some UFO debunkers tried to claim, that there was never any call made, but, you know, it was listened to by the operator. She reported it to the sheriff. He sent deputies over there, and but my family had recovered me before they arrived.
So, Mike, you guys went through polygraph tests. Was it the day of or the day before or something like that that Travis ended up turning back up?
Well, the incident happened on a Thursday evening. They searched. It happened on a Wednesday evening. That's right. Anyway, they searched for 4 days, which was, all the way up through until Sunday evening. And at one point after the second day, Travis Walton's brother and I had to get on to the sheriff. We had to call him up and say, what the hell are you guys doing? You know, you search for 2 days and then that's it. I mean, how thorough was the search? Because Travis's brother and I were both very concerned. And so we pushed them hard. So they went back out, you know, on a Saturday, even though it was a weekend, and a Sunday, and they continued the search. Of course, there were still no results of any kind, but the polygraph tests came Monday. And we're talking all day from early in the morning until after, late, like 9 o'clock at night. And that was quite something. Yeah. So, that filled that entire 5 day period.
And so what was your first reaction when you heard Travis was back?
I didn't hear until the next day. I don't even remember who told me. I think it was Dwayne, his brother, called me and told me. But it was a day later, and then of course it was another day or so before I went down to Phoenix, where Dwayne had taken Travis to see him, and he didn't talk too much to me. He was kind of like lost in a daze. Which I certainly understood, you know.
Yeah, well, explain your mindset at that time, Travis.
Well, I was not really capable of fending for myself. And, you know, my two brothers, two older brothers, one Vietnam vet, one a Korean vet, and they were involved in this. And Mike had the most involvement with Dwayne. He was the Korean vet. But Vietnam vet Don was rather aggressive in his attitude towards the crew, and he kind of seemed to be in favor, according to their description, of the theory that they had murdered me. And so he had some confrontations with the guys. My brother Dwayne had a sighting himself years before, and so he knew Mike, you know, he sort of trusted Mike. He'd worked for him before. So he was much more believing, early on. And so Dwayne was the one that protected me from overly aggressive interrogation. I mean, if the sheriff had gotten a hold of me, they would have torn me to pieces, because I really was in no shape to talk to anybody.
I can vouch for that.
Yeah. I don't know that you ever get over something like this. Did you felt like you got somewhat back to normal after somewhat of a period of time, Travis?
No. Of course, it was a gradual reduction in my PTSD. That's what they call it today. But at the time, I was in pretty serious. I didn't want to go back to the woods. As a matter of fact, the whole crew didn't go back. So Mike just kind of let that one. They relet the contract to another crew.
But, yeah, they defaulted the contract is what they did.
But it was totally understandable, you know, that these guys would do that. And, you know, I give credit to Mike and, you know, all of them actually for mounting a search that night, to coming back and trying to see if they could save me. And that matters a lot. The description that they had of the craft departing was later confirmed. See, a lot of the evidence that supports this came wasn't immediate to the sheriff. He was going on just, you know, what he had. And there was a vacationer at Black Canyon Lake there that had seen the craft depart, and, you know, it matched the description that the crew had given to the sheriff. And there was another deer hunter and his wife that were near there. It was deer hunting season at the time. And he saw the departing craft, too. Actually, his job was in military intelligence, so I considered him to be a very good witness.
Travis, did you feel that they took from you anything, or that they gave you something, or maybe it was a little bit of both?
Well, that would be speculation, you know. I think the whole incident took a whole lot from all of us. And, you know, the two crewmen that are no longer with us died of heart attacks. And I kind of speculate that that kind of stress over their life might have contributed to that.
Do you feel that maybe they blessed you with a, you know, a good bill of health for the hell they put you through or something like that? You've been relatively healthy through life, Travis? I mean, you don't have to give us your life history, but...
Well, coincidentally, you know, there was a huge span of time there where I did have remarkable health. But, you know, I worked at it, so it's the kind of thing that you make that claim and people are going to, you know, try to discredit you. So any other sightings I had, you know, I won't even report them unless there's multiple witnesses. And... Same thing with, you know, I didn't call in sick for 20 years, but that could just be because I avoided bad habits, you know.
We'll continue our program Fire in the Sky after the break. My guests, the wonderful Travis Walton and Mike Heston Rogers. And I'm hearing from those of you on the great KXL that you're letting them know you want a second hour. You want the full program, so keep it up. We'll be back with Travis and Mike.
Into the Paranormal is streaming 24/7 on the TuneIn Radio app and at ParanormalRadio.com.
What you believe might not be. Step into the zone of the best unknown. UFOs, aliens, ghosts, Bigfoot. Conspiracies and cover-ups. And to the paranormal we go.
When the lights go down, the strange comes out into the paranormal.
I'm Jeremy Scott, and I'm with Travis Walton and Mike Heston Rogers. Fire in the Sky. 855-790-8255. Toll free in North America, that's 855-790-8255. Outside North America, 503-506-0396. 503-506-0396. And Skype callers at ITP51. And of course, that's Johnny Cobb along with Jerry McCoy, who do our theme song. And I'm so glad to have them be a part of the show each and every week. I'm thrilled, I'm honored, more like it, to have Travis and Mike here tonight. It is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. We do have some questions that are coming in through our Facebook Live stream tonight. And one of those questions was from Susan. Was Travis clothed when he was returned?
Hollywood fiction. I was not naked. That's typical. You got to have some naked in there. They had some more nudity than that. They got clipped out. The crew was telling me about.
I guess that sells. I don't know.
I was fully clothed, but my brother Dwayne, who was with my brother-in-law, who picked me up that night, had the presence of mind to take all of the clothing I'd been wearing and seal it in a bag for forensic examination. But there was so much hell being raised and pointed in accusation, all kinds of crazy stuff going on, that the bag got put in the back of the car and stuff got thrown in on it and it got torn open and was contaminated. So that forensic testing never occurred.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. So were the clothes, beat up? I mean, you've probably been through a lot. You'd been out there, cutting down trees all day long. But from a five-day journey abducted by aliens on a spaceship.
No obvious signs of that, but definitely work clothes that, you don't wear your best stuff when you go out to work in the woods. It's really hard on everything you wear. And if you're not careful, it can be hard on your body in serious ways. I think I only got one chainsaw cut on my leg in all those years, but it happens. You learn. It's something you definitely don't want to happen again.
How many times did you get hit by a chainsaw?
Cut?
Yeah.
I got nipped once on the leg, just nipped. And then one time I got nipped on my hand, which happened rather by a weird circumstance. And that's all.
In both sense, you guys came out for a career in logging relatively unscathed then.
Well, yeah.
Well, I think
because
Mike,
I spent
Mike
many, many years in it, and I cut down great big trees up on the north rim of the Grand Canyon after that, and logging other than that, on the rim here and stuff. So I really got into it, and I never once had an accident. I fell one time because a big tree, after I bucked it, just literally jumped out from under me, and I fell about 12 feet and sprained an ankle, but that was it.
Yeah, no, he did well in the logging festival, the logger contest. So there's a variety of skills, which include things like axe throwing and log tossing and stuff.
Well, Travis tried that axe throwing one time with my axe, and he did pretty good.
Did you?
We also Travis and I both boxed when I was 28, so which would make him about 23, I think. We boxed ring fought, and both of us did pretty well. I was undefeated. He had one loss, I think, maybe.
I challenged my loss to a rematch, and
that's right. Yeah, that's right.
So you had a little bit of an amateur fighting career, huh, Mike?
Yeah, both of us, yeah. Of course, I had a lot more bouts in the street.
Okay, what was it like after that? I mean, Mike, you said that this the company who had you logging basically reneged on the contract. Did you immediately go back to work? Travis, what was your mindset? Did you want to go back to work? Or what was it like in the weeks after?
I felt like I needed to go back, and eventually I returned to the work in the woods to cut firewood by myself. But ridiculous, you might think. I took a rifle with me. If there was any danger of a repeat, it didn't occur. But, my wife, Mike's sister, kept an eye on how long it took to get out there and get back safely, nothing more happened, at least that I know of.
Okay, so... Did you guys continue to work together over the years?
Yeah, we did some, various times.
What would you say it's been like, Travis, having gone through this and being maybe scrutinized at first, and then in some crowds, certainly in my crowd, you're a hero, you're a legend. I know those are hard words for some people to accept, but it's true. And so what has that been like for you?
Well, I do not take to that idea of hero at all. I don't want to be known for something that just happened to me. It'd be great to be, you know, recognized for some skill or some thing I accomplished, but I've had to, you know, deal with being known, and that's not always a good thing. There's actually people who've made threats. But those people are really just expressing their own fears.
Yeah, Travis does have one accomplishment that I know about besides riding. He is a very fast runner. Very fast.
Wow.
It's you know, that run I was planning on making back to the truck, get the hell out of there with the rest of the crew.
That was, no, I'm that talking was, about running, most, you know, like Olympic speed.
Yeah, I have some pretty fast times. I'd still like to go back, even for my age group, you know. Heck, if I could run the times I used to have for my age group right now, that would be a record, you know.
Yeah, wow. But, I did not know this.
I have a lot of stories to tell about Travis.
My brother, like Dwayne, was also very fast.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
He actually sparred with Muhammad Ali right here in Sholo.
Yeah, Muhammad Ali came here and to train for, I can't remember which fight it was, but... he was somebody that he saw the value in being able to split wood too. Mike and I have both split a lot of wood in our days, and there's actually a skill in that where you're focusing the speed on the swing and the maximum effort right at the end. That's the reason
That's
Mike was able to, in his boxing, he was able to knock guys out that looked like they were, you know, half again his weight, you know?
Yeah.
You put all the whack right at the end, which is, you know, to be efficient when you're splitting wood, it's just something you learn. And Muhammad Ali at his training camp talked about splitting wood. He swung the axe. He knew that technique instinctively.
Yep. I actually won a contest against some big black guys. at the state fair, you know, this big hammer thing, you know, you hit it, they hit the thing and it rings a bell. I rang it three times in a row, and a couple of these black guys went on right after me, and they were very, very nervous. And they, one of them got angry and threw the thing down and, you know, said some cuss words. I did it several times in a row, three times, you know, three rings and like that. And I got the great big bear for my daughter, you know. that's a good technique. It really is. You take your entire force of your body, all of your weight, all that energy, and you channel it right into your arms and into that hammer or that axe, and you just put it all right there.
Right at the end of the stroke, yeah.
That's right.
And that was something Muhammad Ali actually talked about. There was a whole documentary about his Ali's interest in UFOs, and he came and actually stayed it in Overgaard. The people out there at the Bison Ranch tell me that he stayed there in that hotel nearest where it happened. He was interested, very interested in the subject. He had sightings in connection with all of his major bouts. You know, little out of the way place like Sholo, Arizona, and he winds up coming here to train, you know.
Did I just hear that Muhammad Ali had UFO sightings before his bouts? I've never heard that before in my life.
Yeah. Angelo, out of Angelo Dundee's mouth, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, gentlemen, I am just so honored to have you on the program. I know others are as well. There's some people that do want to talk to you. Keep it respectful or we get you off the air. That's how that works. It's 855-790-8255, toll-free in North America, 503-506-0396, outside North America, and ITP51 on Skype. You who can hear me right now, what's your name and where are you calling from?
My name is Bob Eckert, calling from Rochester, New York.
Hello, Bob. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Do you have a question or comment?
I do. And my question is simple. I'm wondering if Mr. Travis Walton has ever considered the Atlantis hypothesis as an explanation for the two of these people were
Can you give him a summary of that in less than a minute?
Sure. Just the idea that they're us, that there's more going on this planet that we know, that, I mean, our myths, obviously the people I'm talking about are known through myth, but maybe Plato was telling the truth, that there have been and will be again many destructions of mankind arising from many causes.
Thank you.
And I know it seems to be anti-Darwinian, but it's not anti-Darwinian. It's anti-social Darwinism. This isn't anti-Darwinism. This is anti-social Darwinism. But Darwin was wrong when it comes to human beings.
All right, Bob, thank you for calling.
Those are philosophical package deals. And, you know, I have done some speculating in those areas. But like I say, that's all speculation. It's entertaining. I've done it. You know, I've looked into that. Connections between, you know, what we saw and what happened. And even my own, you know, now we have these DNA tests that you can take. So that's interesting stuff. But that's a bit off topic for this show.
All right. Well, people do want to know, have any of either of you have been regressed?
I have. I believe Steve Pierce has. That was a horribly traumatic experience for him. Actually, my hypnosis was very skillfully done and really helped me control a lot of the PTSD I had.
Did you have more than one, Travis?
I'm trying to remember. I don't think so.
Okay. What about you, Mike?
Dr. Hart had attempted to hypnotize me one time, and I didn't feel anything happening. But I am a rather hard-headed guy, you know. he couldn't penetrate
that. I think Mike hypnotized Dr. Harder.
Oh, well, maybe. I seem to have that kind of a effect on some people. Not on my ex-wife or girlfriends.
Unfortunately.
No, they control me, I can tell you that.
Yes. This is good stuff here. Travis, is there a message that you want to get out from your experience?
Yeah, I think it's a simple one, you know, that how limited the idea is that we're all there is, you know, just the simple math. You don't have to look at what happened to us to understand that the universe is so big, and there are so many. I mean, even the astronomical theories have grown since this happened to us. There was a thing called the Drake equation.
That's
right. It was an estimate of the possible civilizations in our own galaxy.
Yeah.
But that was based on an estimate of how many stars would have a habitable planet.
Yeah, the whole thing is a formula of estimation.
Or any planets at all. But just this last year, NASA said it. They know for a fact that virtually every star has about a dozen planets. And even though they can't see the planets themselves, there's a process where they measure a cyclic dimming of the star that shows that something is rotating in front of it, blocking the light for a uniform amount of time. And for that reason, they say that all the stars have planets. And so the estimation about the number of possible habitable planets is very much larger than it used to be. And also, what I was saying earlier about they've now got better science and have discovered water on basically everything except the sun in our solar system.
Mm-hmm. The existence of the Earth is extremely rare, and that's a terrible understatement. I mean, it's an absolute miracle that life exists. It's a miracle that this planet exists.
That's true. You know, when you think about all these comets and meteors and things crashing down from the sky, and you know what might have killed the dinosaurs and all the things that could come along and put a stop to billions of years of progress that life forms take.
Yeah, and that's not nearly it. I mean, there's all kinds of things that could be wrong but aren't. I mean, thousands, hundreds, millions of things that could be wrong. We just happen to be in exactly the right place at exactly the right time. It just goes on and on and on like that. Life here is so precious, so rare. I can't get over it. That's true. An overwhelming fact.
You pick any one thing, this planet has to be this size with this degree of tilt and this distance from its star. It's just on and on and on. The conditions for life or everything had to be right, and it was.
Yeah, our position in the galaxy, for one thing.
Yeah.
And I'm always struck down with a little bit of, it does upset me when I hear studies and from smart people who tell me things like, well, there's just no chance that life, exists. I'm actually reading a book about physics right now and about things that are playing out simultaneous to us. And so for all we know, the craft could have been there. Travis could have been there when you returned, Mike, with the truck and the crew, but you just didn't see him.
Oh, parallel universe thing. Boy, you run into all kinds of theories out there talking to people about this stuff. But I think Mike and I pretty much stick to the nuts and bolts of what happened. It's not that these other theories aren't.
Because the other possibility is that you traveled, many light years away to another galaxy. I'm trying to think that there's a possibility that, they kept you more local. You were just, shielded or hidden.
Well, the odds of these beings just coming here by, say, rocket travel or something, it's got to be something far more sophisticated than that. And just because of the distances involved and the science as we know it, they've got to have a grip on physics far beyond anything we have come up with yet.
Yeah. Yeah, man tries to put everything in his on his level, his ability to comprehend, and intelligence goes way, way, way beyond that. And so what's happening doesn't necessarily require a parallel universe. It could just require technology that we cannot even begin to comprehend.
Yeah, for sure. You got to think virtually everything technological that we have has happened in the last 300 years. Before that, humans had this thing called fire, and that was about it. We knew how to chip rocks and make them sharp, but other than that, it's an amazing amount of accomplishment in 300 years. But if you picture the what the astronomers say about these other planets, the age of their civilizations could be hundreds of millions or billions of years beyond ours, and we can't begin to imagine. I mean, look how far we come in 300 years. How far? Who would dare guess what will happen in the next 100 for humans?
Yeah, and a lot of uncharted territory, a lot of more discoveries to be made. I just want to say this, so you gentlemen know, a lot of people, more than you know, are enjoying what you're laying down tonight. They're enjoying hearing the stories from you, in your words, not in someone else's. It's Fire in the Sky with Travis Walton and Mike Heston Rogers. I'm Jeremy Scott on Into the Paranormal.
Are you connected with us on social media? Give us a like and follow at Paranormal Show.
This is Brad Bernards with Paranormal News. Orbital Assembly Corporation recently unveiled new details about its ambitious Voyager station, which is projected to be the first commercial space station operating with artificial gravity, according to Space.com. Here's Don Blinkow, Gateway Foundation President and CEO of Orbital Assembly.
Voyager Station will be the first rotating space station in history. Voyager Station is a stepping stone to larger spaceports and settlements that will ring our world as space construction becomes a common occupation and many people choose to live off-world.
The manufacturing firm centered on the colonization of space discussed Voyager Station during a video press junket. The January 29th First Assembly virtual event served as an update for interested investors, marketing partners, and enthusiastic vacationers hoping to someday book a room aboard the rotating Voyager Station. Neanderthals, the closest ancestor to modern humans, possessed the ability to perceive and produce human speech, according to a new study published by an international multidisciplinary team of researchers, including Binghamton University anthropologist Professor Rolf Quam and graduate student Alex Velez, and reported by EurekaAlert.org. This is one of the most important studies I have been involved in during my career, says Quam. The results are solid and clearly show the Neanderthals had the capacity to perceive and produce human speech. This is one of the very few current ongoing research lines. The evolution of language and the linguistic capacities of Neanderthals in particular is a long-standing question in human evolution. There's more news at parabnormalradio.com. I'm Brad Bernards, Parabnormal News.
It was a terrifying experience.
I thought we was going to go to jail for murder.
That day, we were a little behind, so we worked until it was starting to get dark.
We loaded up the equipment and hadn't driven very far when we caught glimmers of this glow coming through the trees. I urged Mike to hurry up and get up there.
Travis had the door open before we even stopped. As he got closer, I heard the sound.
One of the guys said, "You feel that?"
I really panicked then.
I told him, "Get the hell out of here."
It didn't come directly to me. It came to a deputy sheriff.
Three of us volunteered right away to tell him what had happened.
Sheriff Gillespie definitely didn't believe it.
He says that we better be certain because we could get in a lot of trouble.
When we went to search the next day, they split us up, and the whole time the deputies asked me, if you just tell us where the body is, we can all go home and get this over with.
We're talking about 100 people combing through the wooded area. Nothing turns up.
All week long, I've been hearing they're going to set it up to make you guys look guilty.
We're a rough-looking bunch, then. Some of us have been in trouble with the law before.
And y'all ain't never going to come out of that jailhouse.
We couldn't get out.
I tried to sneak out the back door the day of the polygraph test. I was scared to death.
On top of that, you have media.
I literally would be on two telephones at the same time.
We've even got some kooks in here now that's coming in and out to see the freak show, as they call it.
Everyone dissents.
I just wasn't going to stand there listening to it anymore.
Granny says, "This is Travis. I'm back. I need help."
When I did hear that he had been returned, it was almost as unbelievable as the original thing.
I just looked at my mom and says, "I told you we didn't kill him."
Travis Walton reappeared after several days with a bizarre story about a ride in an unidentified flying object.
People were desperate to explain it away.
"Why are you sticking up with Travis for all this time? You know this really didn't happen."
What happened to Travis after we took off in that truck, I can't tell you.
I hated Travis for a long time after this. My whole world just tore up.
But I believe every word Travis said about it. He's never lied to me about nothing.
It's a net negative. We lost our jobs in the immediate aftermath.
And now you're not able to talk about it with anyone because you know that they're going to laugh at you, they're going to look at you like you're crazy.
But if you don't come out and tell your story, somebody else is going to tell it for you.
There's a degree of responsibility. Certainly I have to accept the bad. If I can direct what's happened in a way that I can make something good happen in the world, I'm looking for it.
Exploring the possibilities of the subjects you've always wanted to know, and those you never knew existed until now. Into the Parabnormal with Jeremy Scott.
As I was told, it's one for my time capsule. Fire in the Sky tonight with Travis Walton and Mike Heston Rogers. I'm Jeremy Scott. If you have not followed us on our social media, we'd love to have your likes and follows. We don't spam you. We give you interesting news articles throughout the week that we find of interest. And, of course, make sure you always know who's coming on the program and how you can access the shows. You can get all of the information at ParabnormalRadio.com. We do Facebook, we do Twitter, we do Instagram, and our YouTube channel as well. We're going to go and take a call here as we return to our conversation with Travis and Mike and welcome this person, I believe, in Nashville, Tennessee. Hello.
Hey, Jerry, this is Johnny Cobb.
Oh, my gosh. It's Johnny Cobb, ladies and gentlemen.
I just want to tell you, Travis and Mike, great show. I'm a faithful follower of Jeremy's. And I had one quick question for Travis and Mike.
Fire away.
Are you going to be appearing at any, either in person at any of the conventions or conferences or by virtual this year?
In the year of the pandemic, Travis, are you going on tour?
Did we lose Travis?
Maybe we did. We lost Travis.
For me, I probably won't be on the radio. I mean, I've had my own show there for 14 months, something like that. I would do it again, but that's my contribution. If, you know, it has been and would be again. I don't think I'd be going to any conventions if they even have any, you know.
Travis is back, and Johnny wants to know, Travis, are you going to be going on tour to any events physically or virtually this year?
Well, I might. It was booked pretty full, but then once this pandemic broke out, everybody postponed. There's a couple have tried to, give me tentative dates.
You're not coming to McMinnville, Oregon, are you?
No, that's not a one that's been renewed.
Darn.
What was I thinking? Well, there's one coming up in Sedona. I don't know the name of it or the date of it or anything. It's a friend of my son's wanted me to come and be there for that. There's two things going on in Sedona, so don't get those two confused. But in the near future,
I'm sure they can get more information about that online by doing a Google or a Facebook. Or it's unfortunate that we haven't been able to gather.
Yeah, it's really disrupted things. But you know. This is a friend of my son's. He lives up here, and he wanted Luke to get me to agree to be there. So I don't even know if I'm supposed to talk or just be there, but that's coming up here in a week or so.
Fantastic. Well, Johnny, we appreciate, and this is Johnny Cobb, by the way, Johnny Cobb from Nashville. He does our theme song. Hey, and
Johnny. He did mine, too, and I really like that guy. I look like both those guys.
Oh, Travis?
Yeah.
Jerry and I are working on something special for you guys. So as soon as we have it ready, I'll be emailing to you.
Sounds great.
Yeah, I think he's doing a Travis Walton theme song. That's exactly what he's doing.
There's a band called Travis.
There's a band called Travis, you said?
Yeah, it's not my band.
I was going to ask what instrument you played.
I'm not. They deny they even named the band after me. So, but they got a song called Sides that has a UFO kind of a video that goes along with it. But I checked, and they say nope. It's got nothing to do with that, with me. So, but it is a well done video.
I mean, has that been a problem, Travis, with people trying to make a buck off of you and your story?
Oh, yeah. Right now, there are copies of our book that are for sale by some guy in Ohio, I think. And he's selling them for $69 a copy, and they're just totally stolen, you know. Mm-hmm. People do that all the time. I was in Roswell, and somebody came up with a copy of the very first edition we did back in when it was called The Walton Experience. And they wanted me to sign this book, and it was completely different. You know, the book first one we did was with Berkeley Books, and this was just completely different format, different size and everything, and they wanted me to autograph this Walton experience that they had. So, you know, people are, you know, rip-off artists, and I would think that, you know, Amazon ought to be more responsible about letting
okay, so I just bought your book at travis-walton.com, and it came autographed, and I haven't had a chance to get through it because I'm savoring it so much. It's kind of like, you know, you save the best for last. Some people prefer the cream filling and the Oreos, and so they save it for last. Some people prefer the marshmallows in their cereal, so they save those for last. And I'm just waiting until I can actually sit down and dedicate a lot of time to this book, Fire in the Sky. I bought it the right way off your website. Do you recommend people do it that way or not do Amazon? Because I'm totally fine with them just going to your website.
Well, I haven't gone to Amazon yet. My wife keeps saying I should, but I haven't done that yet. But just be sure that it's genuine. I just wanted to say that Mike did a fantastic job on the illustrations in that book nobody else could have done it, you know.
Yeah, Mike, you're a pretty talented artist. How did you develop this gift?
It was a gift, you know, from the aliens. No. It's a developed skill. Truth is, if I take my granddaughter's crayons, I can't even draw stick people good, you know. She can do better than I can.
Oh, well, you know, I'm just, you know, it's a sign painter, you know, as a sign painter that you were, you know, creating things, whatever the customer asks you to create, you somehow.
Yeah, I can paint photographs on billboards, you know. I've done that a number of times. Yeah, I don't know where it comes from. From my mom, I guess.
So you were a good artiste in school growing up?
Somewhat. It's acquired. You have to work at it.
What about his mom, Travis?
Yeah, she did a number of paintings, yeah.
Yeah, one of them was of Sedona, the Red Rocks. Sedona. Yeah, you were speaking of Sedona a minute ago.
Jason wants to know, does the crew stay in touch and get together regularly?
No.
I try to stay in touch with some, but no. You know, John and Steve are long-haul truckers, truck drivers, and so they're lucky to stay in touch with their immediate families.
John is. Steve, I don't think, is doing it anymore.
Well, it's been off and on. He was a long-distance truck driver.
Yeah, he was.
And then he wasn't, and then he was, and so I don't
I mean, that's hard work. I mean, you guys, you know, worked your fingers to the bone, so to speak, as they say.
Yeah.
Well, we did in the woods, that's for sure. Nowadays, they just sit around and paint and write, you know.
Hopefully, the bucket list doesn't come very soon, at least not, you know, in my lifetime. I want you guys to outlive me. what is left on the bucket list, Travis?
Boy, I'd like to start training again.
For running?
Yeah, that's pie in the sky.
What about you, Mike?
I just want to get this book done I'm working on.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'm interested in his book.
Yeah, the book is will be called Natural Illusions, and that involves something I came up with. You won't find anywhere else, Natural Illusions. Basically, what a natural illusion is something, it's a big thing. It can be small, it can be huge, but it basically is what you cannot avoid. There's no way in the world to avoid it. And then, of course, there's a man-made illusions, which, of course, you can't. You can try to avoid it, you know. But the commercials, for instance, there are so many tricks in those. You'll think you're seeing something. No, you're not. And it's all designed to show you something, get you enticed into something that you wouldn't necessarily otherwise. And then, of course, there's mental illusions. And this last thing that I've been working on lately is called virtual perception, which is quite unique. In fact, nobody's come up with that. You know, there's virtual reality, but virtual reality is actually virtual perception. And virtual perception happens in a lot of ways, pretty complicated, but it's, in fact, it's as complicated as it is hard to understand. It's, obviously, but yeah.
Coincidentally, I don't know if it's a coincidence, but I've had people lately ask me if, do you have any proof that the life we're living right now, everything we see around us, isn't some kind of an illusion created for us to experience? Sometimes yeah. when we...
Oh, you know, I've got about close to 50 of these featured natural illusions, which will be pages in the book. You know, of course, the writing will more explanation will be in between. But I've got close to 50 of those now, and that's what I'm doing right now. I'm kind of perfecting those, you know, getting the wording right. And because, you know, I first put them out there quickly, and since then, my publisher has been saying, you know, you need to tighten up on those a little. So that's what I'm doing. And that's
have you been able to spot the differences in these? How basically spot these different kinds of illusions, Mike?
How do I spot them? I started doing this in 1976, right after the incident, when so many people were saying that was just an illusion. And so I started looking into illusion. I found out there's really not much. You know, there's optical illusions, and then delusional and things like that, you know, but they never really categorized it. Nobody ever really seemed to have really gotten into it. And so that's what I've been doing now for 45 years and more than anything. And I've gotten so many of them, you know. One of them is, for instance, this is a big one. You look up at the sky, you see a whole sea full of stars. I mean, especially up in the high country where the air is crisp and clean. But, you know, if it wasn't for a huge illusion, I've done the science, I've done the mathematics, and if it wasn't for the fact that we have, you know, the stars have tremendous flare, light flare, to the extreme, you know, that if stars were, could only be no larger than that, they could be shiny, but appear no larger than they actually are. We would not be able to see a star at all, not by a long shot. The skies would be just jet black. That's it. Because in actuality, that light flare increases the size, the apparent size of a star, way over 3,000 times. I have the exact figure, but, you know, it's 3,228 for the close, you know, Proxima and Alpha Centauri.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you so much. It has been my honor to have you both on this program. It means so very much to me that we could have you both on at the same time in your own words, telling your story, telling the story. You know, Travis, are there any other misperceptions or even any closing comments, whether it's been how your theories have changed over the years or any closing words you might leave the audience?
Well, yeah, definitely, you know, my perceptions of it. At the time, I considered it an abduction, and maybe not, you know. Maybe it was more of an accident. I've compared it to an ambulance call that somehow I got hurt, and that made it necessary to make it not a fatal incident. Something of that nature, you know, that sort of cancels out that idea that the Hollywood take on things, that these are invading monsters, and that maybe, you know, you would think that an extremely, extremely advanced civilization would have outgrown the kind of hostilities that we consider to be part and parcel to, you know, various entities, you know, our brothers on the planet.
Yep.
Mike, what would you leave us with?
Oh, well, I would leave you with, when I get this book done, it's going to be offered to, you know, the public. But if a person doesn't understand the illusions in life, which are many, many, it's no wonder that people don't understand reality. They want to come up with all kinds of things otherwise, you know. But if you understand the illusions, then you might be able to understand what reality really is. And that's my thought right there.
The realist Mike Heston Rogers and Travis Walton, an amazing show tonight. I want to thank you both so very much once again. I hope this is not the last time we talk, but if it is, this will go down on my bucket list as mission accomplished.
Well, thank you, Jeremy.
It's my pleasure.
See, I'm open to it.
And I hope to maybe see Travis one of these days when we can get back to some of these conventions, conferences, festivals. It's certainly going to be nice to be able to do that. We will be doing the Oregon Ghost Conference virtually at the end of the month on Saturday and Sunday. For the second year in a row, we do it virtually. We've done that show virtually more times than we've done it in person. And supposedly, the McMiniman's UFO Festival is happening later this year. They've had to cancel the Oregon Bigfoot Festival, sadly. And so here, the state that we are, I'm hoping that one of these days that we can get back out and congregate. And Mike says those illusions around us, you know, they do tend to distract us from the truth, and perception is an awfully big deal. I want to say a special goodbye to a special woman in ufology. I've just been waiting for the right time to say this. I know Travis knows Angelia Scheer. She was on the program just a very short months ago. I heard she wasn't doing well, and she's passed. Her UFO knowledge has gone to another realm, and we miss her, and the UFO field misses her. God bless you, Angelia Scheer. Good night from the cold, dark depths of a secret dungeon somewhere deep in the remote Pacific Northwest. I'm Jeremy Scott. Good night, everyone.